as we move into summer and possibly more intense weather events, company directors, banks and utilities are all being warned by our financial regulators to consider climate change as a financial risk, not an environmental risk, but a material financial one, a risk that should be understood, disclosed, then priced, and thus incorporated into prudent business planning. One of the leading voices in Australia is Jeff Summerhayes, an executive board member of APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority. Recently, he's argued that companies ought to prepare for sea level rise and more frequent natural disasters. He said he didn't want to overstate things, but the aim was to avoid any shocks to balance sheets, particularly affecting potential insurance. Now, to understand this landmark shift affecting attitudes towards roads, dams, harbourside homes, exposed country towns, I'm joined now by Carl Mallon, who's the Director of Science and Systems at Climate Risk. He's an expert in bringing together all the data to find risky assets, and he's having quite a lot of success in selling this to countries here and over, to companies here and overseas. I'd also like to welcome Sarah Barker from Minter Ellison. She provides legal advice to the private and government sector about reporting climate change risks. Welcome to you both.
Hello, Geraldine.
Some context first, Sarah, if we could. Why would you say we're now hearing from regulators and rating agencies about describing the financial risks of climate change?
Yeah. In the last couple of years, there's been a really demonstrable shift amongst the prudential supervisors around the world, a change in attitude, recognising that the environmental consequences of climate change have second-order effects for financial markets. There are economic transition effects that present financial risks, not just to our financial system as a whole, but to individual companies, to individual investors, that really do need to be proactively managed rather than just left to run their own course if we're going to minimise damage to the economy more broadly.
And they're not at the moment. They feel that this is not on some radar?
It is emerging on radars, I think. A pivotal year was 2015 when Mark Carney, who is the chair of the Bank of England, was really the first financial regulator to stand up and say, we consider climate change to be a material risk to financial stability. Now, since that time, increasingly we've seen other regulators, including APRA, stand up and echo those views and say, we also understand that.
Now, he said in that speech that these are risks, not certainties, but he was almost saying, I want people to properly consider the nature of risk. How would you advise people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the function of business is to manage commercial risk in the face of uncertainty. No one has a crystal ball. And one of the defining characteristics of climate change as a risk is that it is so broad and there are so many variables at play. So the necessity to stress test and scenario plan across an entire range of quite disparate climate futures.
Because some assets will lose value, and I suppose some lose it acutely.
Absolutely. Some will lose value. There will be winners and there will be losers in climate change impacts and also in the economic transition that we go through as an economy as we shift to a lower carbon norm.
And I mean, are you itemising companies or groups that are at risk, more at risk than others?
It's interesting you say that. A lot of the time we presume that there are certain high profile sectors like fossil fuels, for example, that are more susceptible to damage or to loss in value as a result of climate change. But it really is pervasive across the economy. There was a study that was done in the US very late last year where the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board divided up the US economy into 79 different industries and assessed each of those sectors for exposure to material risks associated with climate change. And it concluded that 72 out of those 79 were exposed to material financial risks from climate change, whether they be environmentally related or whether they be economic transition risks associated with policy change or associated with technological developments.
Carl, it's obviously important not to terrify people, I presume. Like, jumping at shadows isn't wise for the economy either, but it's challenging to think of an asset losing value because of climate change? I mean, what could it be? A road, a big agricultural concern? Could it be a home?
So this is the thing that's, I think, quite interesting, because I think the utility space has been aware of this for a while and has, if you like, a head of steam in terms of looking at its assets and starting to look at management plans to deal with risks from increased flooding, coastal inundation, increased bushfires and so on. Now, one of the things I've personally found quite alarming is that, if you like, that we're still selling, we're still building houses as if there isn't a problem. And, you know, we can point to suburbs around the country that are very susceptible to sea level rise and so forth. So it definitely is a problem for homes. I think what we'll see is insurance prices will have to start to increase in some of these suburbs, and there will be impacts on the value of those homes. And I think one of the things that's incumbent upon folks in my sector is to try and get that information through to those people.
Well, that's one of the things Jeff Summerhayes talked about, is the risk of insurance not being properly priced for the level of risk, which could lead, as he said, to whole areas deciding we'll drop insurance.
So this is one of the things that I think we have to keep in mind, that I'll give you an example. One of the projects that we've got on at the moment is called Climate Valuation. And they can type in any address in Australia, and it will test the insurability of that home, not just today, but over the mortgage period, because that's how long someone takes on, if you like, a liability. So it's not about whether it's insurable today, but whether it's going to be insurable over the whole period of that asset's ownership.
And that's you making an assessment, is it? So it's speculative to that extent, isn't it?
Look, I wouldn't call it speculative. What we're doing is we're anchoring it into the climate change science. So it's based on things like tide gauges, it's based on tectonic gauges, it's based on massive volumes of climate change modelling that comes out of the universities. So in a way, what we're doing is connecting the instruments, the scientific instruments we have, into what ordinary mums and dads use for making a decision about a home they're going to buy. And that's where the shock potentially comes, because we're at the point where we can turn this information into something that an ordinary person can use when they make a decision. And that is where we could have very rapid changes in how people feel about suburbs and how they revalue suburbs.
Now, I presume that there'll be fees paid to use these services that you provide, which would be sort of warning people, but also, in effect, maybe persuading them not to build a home. So there'll be people who'll be... There's a direct clash, is there not?
That's a really interesting point, actually. So one of the tensions we have in here at the moment is that there's no one really sticking up for the people who own and buy houses. If you like, the developers are taking the money for building a house. The insurers are taking their insurance premium for the next year. The banks are lending the money. The councils are taking the rates. And at the moment, we don't have a mechanism to warn people. So they're going to get more protection buying some shampoo in the supermarket than they are buying the biggest asset they'll ever own. And that, I think, is the challenge of the asymmetry in the information that's coming through. So the sorts of things that utilities can get their hands on in terms of information, or companies, is very different from what people on the ground can get their hands on. And that really has to be resolved sooner or later.
Sarah?
There's a phrase that one of the practitioners in this field has coined, a man by the name of Dr. Nick Wood, which is hostile analytics. If you don't have access to that information when you're buying your house, there is going to be a bank or an insurance company that does. So I definitely would echo what Carl is saying about this is really evening up the information asymmetry.
Although presumably they wouldn't extend you a mortgage if they actually decided that it was a risk there.
And that's absolutely right. So wouldn't you like to know that information in advance before you're making a purchasing decision? Because when you take out a mortgage, that's usually when a bank wants to verify that you have insurance. It's usually a term of the mortgage over its entire life. And so if that insurability changes, you might find that you're left with a liability, but that it can't be insured.
Do you believe people are just carrying on, Carl, even if they can't get insurance, which is what Jeff Summerhayes was clearly worried about?
So that point that you're raising is really quite, I think is really quite material, because we've got a kind of double think going on at the moment. If you think about the houses in Collaroy, you know, people...
It was a seaside suburb subject to a terrible storm in the northern districts of Sydney.
That's the one that people saw where the swimming pool was sitting on the sand at the end of the storm. So the interesting thing there is most scientists like me knew that that was a problem waiting to happen. People were given mortgages, and we also know that they were definitely not insured for actions of the sea, which are not covered. So we have this problem, which is we're sort of ignoring problems. People are giving mortgages. So your point that they wouldn't be given mortgages is actually incorrect. They are being given mortgages on quite risky properties. And insurers, quite rightly financially, are not providing cover where they consider the risk to be too high. But we've got this double think between providing mortgages on homes which really shouldn't or can't be insured.
I suppose pulling together the sorts of analytics that you're describing, this is big data, isn't it, Carl? How can you reassure people that this is becoming a better understood science?
So the analytics to get through this, I mean, we have to process something like, you know, 1,000 terabytes of data to be able to do that, which is why it's generally been only governments and utilities that have been able to afford that analytics before. So this is definitely starting to become available to other people. And the system I mentioned, it's being peer reviewed by some of the best climate and sea level rise modelling people in the world to verify that our systems are as correct as they can be. Bearing in mind, we're in uncharted territories with climate change. So really what you're trying to do is give people the best steer that we can with what we know.
And given that our banks are so exposed to residential mortgages, Sarah, how big a shift would this thinking that you're describing represent?
It is a big shift, and it's certainly a big shift for every participant in the financial supply chain, from the top of the chain where you've got investors and banks down to the end of the chain where you've got asset owners, including residential house owners. But I don't think we can shy away from the fact that it is a necessary change, because climate risks and the impacts of climate change are not something that we can think about in 2050 or 2070, which has historically been the way that we've thought of this issue. We're already seeing the impacts now. So whereas it might have been a case that when you bought your house, that a certain level of flood was a 1 in 100 year event, we're seeing that even under current climactic conditions, it's now a 1 in 30 year event, in some cases a 1 in 5 year event. So these are issues that we have to grapple with.
Can I add one thing also, just also to put a positive on that? I want to build on Sarah's point, which is, I know it sounds negative that we're saying, well, there's a problem here and, you know, there's going to be increased flooding and insurance prices are going to go up. But one thing we have on our side is we have foresight. Now, one of the things we can do, so for example, one of the conversations we've got at the moment is with the banks, which is to say, if we identify a property that someone uses climate valuation and finds out they've got a problem, what about the idea of increasing their mortgage so that they can put in remedial measures and essentially make that place resilient to the hazards that are there? Then you've lent more money, they've got a more secure house, and then it's also insurable, so the insurers are happy. We can come up with solutions like that, which are win-wins, and we do it by staring the problem in the face. If there are suburbs where we really have a whole of suburb problem, then again, at a council level or a state level, we can look at things like land swaps, where we can give people the ability to live in their homes, but at some point have a relocation program. Again, we do it before people have suffered catastrophic loss. That's what we've got to really avoid, is people essentially being uninsured and it losing everything.
Very interesting. Thank you both very much indeed, Sarah Barker and Carl Mallon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Geraldine.